I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Round House Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Hello, Martin.
Fabulous to join you as always, Michael.
Well, it's Friday morning in Fremantle, Western Australia. Martin, it's a fairly calm place. On Fridays, the weekly edition of the Fremantle Shipping News gets sent out to thousands of shippies. And I should say that if anyone listening to this podcast would like to get the weekly edition, go onto our homepage, top right, hit the subscribe button, and each Friday you will get the weekly edition. And I can tell you, Martin, that this week's weekly edition, going out later today, is trying to imbue a sense of solitude, even peace, calmness in this wild world we live in. But we're about to churn it all up again by talking about the geopolitical situation, finance, government budgets locally and nationally, what the UN's been up to in trying to phase out fossil fuels, and, you know, is Cuba going to explode next, and so on and so forth, Martin. It's all a bit crazy, isn't it?
Well, I think one of the natural things that we gravitate to in our discussion around the news is all the things going wrong, all the messes, all the dangers, all the conflict. And I'm glad you've got some other content besides that.
Well, let's start today with the Jim Chalmers budget. You get the sense that after all the build-up, including here on View from the Roundhouse, where we were sort of expecting it, if not encouraging it, to try and deal with the housing crisis, to reverse the negative gearing rules, to deal with unnecessary capital gains incentives. So Chalmers did that, but it hasn't sort of fallen on entirely fertile ground, Martin. What have you made of the response?
No, I don't think it's going that well for Chalmers at all at the moment. It's a reminder that when you bring in reform, there's obviously some people that are doing better and some people doing not so well out of these changes. The people that you can guarantee that will arc up are the people not doing so well. And the people that might benefit from this, maybe we don't hear much from them. So the changes to negative gearing will, we believe, many economists say this, take some money out of investment in existing housing, thereby softening the market somewhat, and the increase in prices are likely to be mitigated somewhat by that. But that will take years, Michael. That might be a 3 to 5 year project. It might be longer. In the meantime, all the people that are disadvantaged by these changes, mainly people, potential investors and the like, are not happy, and very clearly not happy. And even some people already take advantage of a system and they don't lose that tax benefit from their current negative gearing assets, would like to do more perhaps, and are unhappy about this. So all the people affected here and now, we're hearing a lot from, and we're probably not hearing a lot from people that would like to get into the housing market in 2 years' time.
Well, the budget, of course, has a whole lot of stuff in it about budgetary matters, not just the matters we've mentioned. You get the impression that overall it hasn't lit up the minds of critics on the left or the right or in the centre. Is it a non-event? I mean, it's happening.
I don't think it's a non-event. And in fact, if the government can't get its messaging right and can't sell this effectively, this is a real game turner here, because the opposition's getting a lot of fuel and they're enjoying this. And Angus Taylor, he brought in his response, which was to index the tax brackets, particularly the low ones first. That's gone down reasonably well. Who doesn't want a little bit less income tax over time, that kind of thing. In the meantime, the government's running around having to sell complex changes and having to really convince people that for the long term, this is going to be better.
Well, it seems that they went in and requested Paul Keating to come to the aid. He's always had a dab hand, a sharp tongue, and a pretty natty way of putting issues. And an opinion piece was published in The Guardian, I think, yesterday. One of the issues that he addressed was one of the sort of the side issues, as it appeared, about startups, about people wanting to start up a business and and make money. It might be a good idea in mining investment. It might be a brilliant tech idea that we wouldn't want to go overseas, offshore. And he sort of came in with a Warren Buffett line, I think, to say, look, people who want to make money and have startups aren't going to be put off by a tax like the one that's just been put in place. But is that another big issue?
It's certainly a political issue at the moment. So the biggest critics of the budget generally are business and particularly investors. And investors will tell you, they'll say, that some investments come off and others don't. And unless there's some investment, some incentive for the ones that do, then you don't take the risk. It's the overall argument, it seems. So the startup element, the risk-taking element, they're worried that when they are successful, they'll get a big tax bill. And when they're not, obviously they're losing a lot of money. And the WA here in Western Australia, there's concern that the mining sector, which is speculative and for which assets rise and fall in value, will be impacted disproportionately.
It's a funny business, isn't it? Running economies, trying to stay afloat, sort of economically, financially. Every national, state, local government wants to have a budget that is sort of balanced, that they don't have too much debt. And Western Australia, which has a notionally left of centre government, perhaps it's more notionally right of centre on deeper reflection. They're happy to keep things like fossil fuels happening, Martin. There's a big company here called Woodside. They've got the Brazi development up in the northwest, which is capable of producing lots and lots and lots of natural gas, lots of environmental concerns about it. And yesterday, the State Premier Roger Cook sort of said, "Well, if we can't go ahead with Brazi, then we'll have to do a whole lot of fracking in the Kimberley region in the north of Western Australia." I think it was just meant to tease environmentalists and upset them. I think many of them are turning up at 10 o'clock this morning to Parliament House to tell him he doesn't know what he's talking about. But Martin, I mention all of this because a landmark General Assembly resolution was adopted on Wednesday at the UN in New York, and it's been described as a powerful affirmation of international law, climate justice, and science by Antonio Guterres, the UN chief. This is an endorsement by 141 countries, 8 against it and 28 abstentions. I should say those voting against it included Iran, Israel, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and the US. But the idea is that there's an obligation to protect us all, a legal duty to protect us all from the fossil fuel fallout. I mean, what's the power, do you think? What's the significance of this UN resolution?
Well, I think it's a major update, and it is conveying quite an important situation about how our global environment is travelling. When you ask about the impact, though, Michael, I wonder whether it is having that impact because the international community is incredibly fractured when it comes to what to do about climate change, if anything. So the US, as you may be aware, is not really inclined to make major change to accommodate unfolding climate change. In fact, if anything, Donald Trump's gone in the opposite direction, markedly so. China's a mixed bag. China's doing a lot around renewable energy. They've got nuclear taking off as well, but also just because of the nature of their economic growth and the base, they are still increasing emissions. So you've got two of the largest polluters there. Then you've got Europe that does have stricter environmental regulations. But even they're getting questioned by countries in Europe, and there's a bit of a popular backlash in the right to some of these things as well. So that is potential to change some of those policy settings, perhaps. And of course, you come back here to Australia, where the coalition has said it's definitely abandoning net zero, and they're under pressure from One Nation on its right flank. So I see the global statement, and then I see the actions being taken by people, by governments in the West, which are per capita, Michael, the highest polluters. And there's complete incongruence for me on those, between those two things.
Well, we used to, some decades ago, talk about the grown-ups having to think about the environment and the need for regulation on behalf of their grandchildren. But I distinctly have the feeling now that we grown-ups either can't do much about it, we're going to have to rely on the grandchildren to do it all when they get their turn, Martin. But take that as a comment, not a question. But talking about China, as we know, President Trump was there, much celebration and pageantry a week or so ago. He didn't seem to leave China with any particular agreements in hand. He kept talking about Boeing selling hundreds of planes to them. Perhaps that was something talked about, but it doesn't sound like an agreement was put in place. And it seemed more an exercise in glad handing and perhaps trying to douse the flames of international tension a little bit. But then, no sooner did Trump go than President Putin of Russia turns up. And he was being glad-handed and glad-handing President Xi of China. Not sure that they've agreed anything either. They apparently wanted a big pipeline agreement, the Russians, but they didn't get it. I mean, what's the significance of all of this going to Beijing and, I'm not sure it's a Chinese word, Martin, but kowtowing?
Well, I think that it's healthy to see Trump and Xi get along because they are the two most powerful countries in the world militarily. And them having some form of personal relationship's not a bad thing. You'll recall, Michael, in the first term of the Trump government in particular, any problem that occurred was China's problem. And they even renamed coronavirus the Chinese virus, you may recall. And I don't think that's really great for global stability. And for Australia, this is a welcome development because our security relationship's still with the US, but our big trade relationships with China. So that's not a bad thing from our perspective. Putin's gone over there now, and the whole Putin-Xi relationship's been changing, Michael, because Putin was very heavily reliant on China for trade when all the sanctions came in after his invasion in Ukraine, and it was very isolated. Putin's taken advantage of the war in the Middle East. He's one of the biggest beneficiaries because all of a sudden, lo and behold, the oil sanctions have been partially lifted on Russia because they need to get their oil from somewhere and they're selling oil again. And China's always obsessed with energy security. They're diversifying, they're making sure they've got a whole range of people that can supply them. So they're happy to take more oil from Russia, as you'll appreciate. So there has been a bit of a change there, where Putin's got a little bit more leverage than he otherwise would have had, mainly because Donald Trump and his war against Iran, that's changed things somewhat.
Well, I guess that's politics, isn't it? You're always wondering what's going to come up next, and you have to be ready to talk, to negotiate, and come to some sensible conclusions. But one place you won't be getting any oil from, in fact, they don't have any at all themselves. In fact, they don't seem to have anything, much of anything, is Cuba. By all accounts, they ran out recently, and it sounds like more than an economic basket case. It's a domestic issue in the United States. The famous Fidel Castro's brother Raul, who's still alive at 93, I think, has just been charged with murder in relation to the planes that were downed some 30 years ago, and the occupants of them died. And Blind and Freddie can see that that the US is putting on the pressure to have Cuba. I don't know what they actually want out of them. Cuba said they're happy to talk. And there's a couple of big aircraft carriers sort of aiming their guns at them right now, I think. So, what do you reckon is going to happen with US-Cuba relations?
Well, it's been fascinating to watch this. Cuba, of course, is one of the big bugbears for the US. For those of you who've been around a while will know this goes right back to, even the 1960s, and JFK was president. A country that sits right on the US's doorstep, but is communist in name, at least, and has good relationships with many of America's rivals. And that's always been seen as a national security issue for the US. And it's a big political issue because there's a lot of ex-Cubans living in the US and they're not very friendly towards the Cuban government. They escaped it, they left it. And that includes none other than the US Secretary of State himself, Marco Rubio. So he's particularly passionate to squeeze the Cuban government. And the latest thing, they put the D on of the revolution. Raul Castro, the brother of Fidel Castro, is now 96 years old. They're putting him on trial, if they can. They've indicted him at least, for the murder of several people during the Cuban Revolution and a few other acts. So that's another form of squeezing them, Michael. But the main thing is really squeezing them economically. And it appears to be working somewhat because their economy is in awful shape at the moment.
I suppose there would simply be a regime change. There'd be the installation of a government that was approved of by Marco Rubio.
Yeah, there's two options. One's a complete regime change, which would probably satisfy them the most. The other one is a marked change in approach by the Cuban government, a bit like Venezuela, Michael, where they might suddenly become, a bit more like a US vassal and accept a whole range of conditions from the US in return for these sanctions being lifted. So there's said to be several intermediaries kind of negotiating a scenario like that, saving the regime, but putting it on an economic setting that satisfies the US and they can get more leverage.
Martin, I have a vague recollection that Napoleon, once having taken over France, then declared himself the emperor or the king of Italy and the like. Do you reckon Marco Rubio would like to become the king or the emperor of Cuba and move across from Florida and set up in Havana?
Look, he has a lot of personal investment in this, and he's spoken out against the Cuban regime for decades, even when he was a junior senator. He ran for the US president in 2016, you may recall, some years ago. So he's one of the most prominent ex-Cuban Americans in the country. So absolutely, there's a personal element for him.
Well, it's time to talk about the other country which causes the US trouble. Cuba can't do what Iran has done so far, survived all of this conflict with the US. But Iran keeps at least pushing its chest out or claiming that it's controlling and as specified in a map, that it sort of has hegemony over the relevant parts of the Gulf of Hormuz. Have you seen that?
Well, the worry that a lot of countries have, and the worry that a lot of international companies have, is that a resolution might give Iran the ability to impose some form of tariff on ships passing through that strait, which would be enormous additional cost for global shipping. Around 20% of the entire global shipping comes through that stra those straits, so particularly a large slice of oil. So that's the main worry there. Will Trump cut a deal that gives them the ability to do that? And that's what they're keen on, I think. But the two main things, as we may have discussed previously, is opening of those straits, but also a focus on the future of the nuclear program in Iran. They're two sticking points.
I'm left, even though you rightly keep telling me that don't listen to anything that President Trump says, look at what he does. The fact that he goes on and on suggesting they're close to resolving something, plainly, if you're a real estate negotiator, is intended to encourage the other party to think in the terms he's stating. But it does make me think that they must sort of be somewhere around about the place, able to come to an agreement on some of these important issues. What do you reckon?
I think it's a. You keep on hearing noises other than Trump, because you've got Trump who just says what he says on social media. But there are other alternative reports coming out of news outlets and also via Pakistan, who's the mediators, that they're close to a deal. So if you add all that in together, that would appear that something's in the offing. But they have been close before, and they actually did face-to-face negotiations about a month ago. So, we've come here close before. Will we finally get a deal? I think it is actually in everyone's interest to cut something.
Martin, the next federal election in Australia, I think, is what, in about the middle, perhaps May 2028.
Yes. So it's the last one was in 25 for about Not quite halfway through, about a third of the way through, bit tick over the third of the way through the term.
I suspect, excuse me, by then the situation with the current budget will be sort of history. It'll play into that election, but there's going to be a number of actors, parties in the election then, Martin. We're going to have all of the community candidate teals running again, absolutely no doubt, and one suspects they'll probably do okay. The Liberal Party, in whatever shape it's in then, will be running. The Nationals slash Country Party will be there if they're still alive in regional Australia. But there looks to be a horse, no longer so much of a dark horse, called One Nation coming belting down the track. Do you reckon they're going to be a big player in the House of Representatives popular elections, Martin, in 28?
Well, certainly as things stand at the moment, yes. They've done very well in South Australia. They did very well in the Farrer by-election. They're still polling very strongly. Some polls have them leading now because Labor support has slipped after the budget. So that's a very encouraging sign for them. There are still some variables when it comes to One Nation. That comes down to their personnel and their organisation. They're quite a volatile organisation with volatile personalities involved. They've splintered before. There's been people who've left that party before. They've had problems with candidates at times. The functionality of the branches, all of those things. Let's see how they transpire. But if you're just looking at the polls at the moment, you'd say they're very strong. Regional Australia, Michael, I expect them to do exceptionally well. Probably struggle a bit more in the cities, but even if they do well in the country, they'll put a lot of pressure on the coalition.
Well, I see they're starting to announce some what might be considered populist, but perhaps they're quite broadly accepted in Australia now, like a sovereign wealth fund that we shouldn't be giving away everything.
Well, there's been certain statements out of One Nation which are interesting, and one of them is this issue of sovereignty. So they've ran heavily on immigration, but you need a bit more than that to your platform. So the latest, you had Hanson come out and oppose gas exports, not entirely, but agree with some form of taxation on them. You had her also backing local manufacturing and the like. So this issue of sort of sovereignty of trade and sovereignty of manufacturing and keeping our resources for ourselves, all those sorts of things, I think that they're going to form part of a developing economic agenda for One Nation that sits alongside their immigration talk.
The next thing we'll hear, the manufacturing unions will be signing coalition agreements with One Nation, Martin.
Well, it probably does. There's probably a bit of overlap at times between some of the rhetoric out of, say, AMWU, that's the main manufacturing union, and One Nation. I think both of them would hate that characterisation because they see themselves as very different. But they both would be talking about the importance of local jobs and local manufacturing, I suspect.
Perhaps we'll be imposing tariffs on clothing coming in from Bangladesh and Korea and Taiwan, Martin.
Well, if you look at historically in Australia, throughout Australia's post-federation history, it's actually certain unions have been most opposed to immigration and most bullish on local manufacturing. That was probably particularly prior to the 1970s. So it's not that unusual.
Well, don't forget, Martin, that the White Australia policy had a fair bit to do with unions way back.
It absolutely did. And Labor was an enthusiastic proponent of the White Australia policy, if you go back along a fair way now, pre-Whitlam in particular.
But Martin, we always focusing, or so often focusing, just on international and national issues. But there's a bit of an issue bubbling around in Western Australia. The regional courts are unable to sit at the moment because they don't have any security to deal with the criminal punters coming before the judges and magistrates. Have you noticed that? Seems pretty odd to me.
It does. I did notice this, and there's a saying that justice delayed is justice denied. And if you're postponing a lot of these hearings and what is going on, people that are facing serious enough charges, of course, they end up being on remand, And so they're sitting effectively in prison across all that time, which is not healthy because they've not actually been judged or sentenced following that. So that's one development which would be most unwelcome. And then there's the general fact that people feel that justice has not been delivered in regional areas. So it's quite concerning. And there are revelations now coming through Parliament that this problem has been known for some time. So then the question is, why wasn't it acted on earlier?
So, would you classify it as largely an industrial issue?
It appears to be an issue of how many police are there and their priority for this kind of work versus, catching crooks and stopping domestic violence and all those other things that they're routinely charged with doing.
It does seem crazy and not being resolved very quickly. As you say, it's been perhaps simmering for some time. Oh well, we'll keep an eye on that, Martin. It's been another busy week around the world. Mind you, the world's been pretty busy for the whole time, I think, since the Great Bang, and certainly since we humans started making a mess of it, what, 5,000 years ago? Depends which biblical tract you're relying on.
Well, you would say, I think humans have always had an impact on their environment, but the arrival of agriculture probably upped that disproportionately.
Well, Martin, on that philosophizing and sort of ahistorical sense, we'll have readers writing into us to sort us out, which we'll gladly receive them.
Very welcome to.
And well, you better get off and run that university, and I'll see you next Friday morning.
Pleasure as always, Michael. Good to talk.